This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with the lead attorney in a case against the U.S. Treasury.
Martin McMahon has filed a dynamite lawsuit in Washington, D.C., which could have real repercussions from those who are funding the illegal settlements in the Israeli army.
Islamophobia continues to be on the rise in the United States. Professor Arun Kundani joins us to talk about why this is.
What's the basis of fear of Muslims? Listen in.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
The U.S. Treasury has long turned a blind eye to as many as 150 nonprofits that funnel up to $1 billion a year to Israeli settlements and the Israeli army, according to a federal complaint filed this December. The department finds itself a defendant in this newly filed lawsuit by Washington, D.C. attorney Mark McMahon. Rather than engaging in charitable activities, these nonprofits, supported by U.S. donations, are allegedly fueling land theft, forcible expulsion of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their land, demolition of homes, and paramilitary activities carried out by armed Israeli settlers against Palestinian civilians. Joining us today to talk about this lawsuit is Martin McMahon. He is the founding member and managing partner of the Washington, D.C.-based Martin McMahon and Associates. Martin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
We were so excited to learn about this litigation. Tell us how you got involved, and if you will, tell us about some of the plaintiffs.
Yeah, first of all, regarding involvement, in January of this year, a Palestinian client of mine met with me at Starbucks to go over some issues concerning some property issues in the Middle East, but at the end of that, he said, you know, Martin, I'm still awfully upset with what's going on in Palestine. You're, you know, a creative attorney. You're my friend for 30 years. Can you do something about it? So I said, I'll tell you what, I'll look into it. I've always sort of wanted to do it. That was in part because of my Irish background. I knew what the Brits did during the occupation. So Seamus and I, a young associate, is here in the room, started looking into things, and we realized a lot of folks have asked Treasury to do the investigation. Nothing has happened. So we knew that the hurdle of exhaustion of administrative remedies, you know, we probably were okay with that. And then we started doing all our research and started to discover all these tax-exempt entities and started to realize this is a massive problem. And it involves money laundering, all sorts of stuff. So the plaintiffs are an unusual bunch. Michael Severill, I don't know, did we send you the affidavit?
Yes. We've read it.
Yeah. Very interesting guy. We stumbled upon his research, and then he wanted to be a plaintiff, of all things. And I thought he represents a large portion of American Jews who really are concerned about settlements, you know, and Israelis, too. So, and then I attended a book signing event with Susan, and I never discovered why she was big stuff. And then we had an Egyptian client who felt that the same things that happened in Cairo to him, being thrown in jail and facing 30 years without any, you know, appearances or judicial rights. So he wanted to join.
But tell us about Susan.
Well, Susan is a famous author. I didn't know that. And we stumbled upon her, too, as a matter of fact. Did you read her piece? I thought it was beautiful.
No, I didn't. But tell us, she's a well-known Palestinian poet. Tell us about her.
Well, in the lawsuit, she recites the fact that basically I want somebody to make accountable the Israeli officials who have stolen my identity, have basically made sure I could never return home, and all sorts of good things in there. I almost feel like quoting her, but after the interview, if you read her statement on page 4, it'll bring tears to your eyes. She just can't believe that the world just doesn't seem to care. Seamus? Seamus will read you a significant part, the last part, Seamus.
Thank you.
Okay, she says here...
Seamus, introduce her and pronounce her last name correctly for me, please.
Sounds good. Yeah, it's Susan Abelhoa. And she, I think she's based in Pennsylvania. She's Palestinian and has described in conversations to us how her family and her, you know, her life has been affected by this, by the settlement and what's been going on there. She says, I want a court somewhere, somehow, to hold accountable those who have financed my pain of dispossession and exile, to hold accountable the financiers of Israel's wholesale theft of another people's historic, material, spiritual, and emotional presence in the world.
Pretty powerful statement.
I'll say. Well, what kind of activities are going on in these settlements? How many people live there? Where are they? What do they do? What have they done to the Palestinians? What are we talking about?
Well, we tried to lay out the settlement activity, and whatever year it is, people are encouraged by then-Housing Minister Sharon to grab hilltops owned by Palestinians, because in the final analysis, when the final borders are set, if we don't grab that stuff, you know, then we can't keep it. So basically the settler movement was borne out by Sharon's, who's the father of settlements, by the way, his desire to sprinkle Jewish settlers all over the OPT, because he knew the day of reckoning would come, final borders are set, and if you have something built up. And that was basically 40 years ago, I guess. So they were looking for cheap real estate, and they received economic incentives from the Israeli government and decided, you know, too expensive to live in Haifa, Tel Aviv, and Jerusalem. Let's live out here in the boondocks. And the problem was that when they first set up, they lived in tents, had no electricity, had no water, sewer. I mean, they were really pioneers. So their Jewish brethren in basically America decided, you know, we should help our folks. And the way we help them is financial assistance so they can have a permanent living structure, hospitals, universities. And 40 years later, Ariel has 25,000 people. It started with six tents and two outhouses. Now it has 25,000 people. They have a fantastic university, a fantastic medical center, hospitals all over the place, movie theaters, drama, you know, everything under the sun, and vast infrastructure improvements. And they even have an Ariel University, which is basically illegal because it was built on private land, as conceded by a number of Israeli officials and, you know, distinguished authors.
Martin, why do you say that the U.S. Treasury Department has a double standard?
Well, it's kind of obvious. Sometimes folks make too much of the Israeli lobby, but I think it's fair to say that Treasury, for a lot of reasons, has looked the other way when it comes to pro-Israel or pro-settlement 501c3s. Because, you see, and this stuff is nothing new. People have been writing about it for years. I don't know, you know, if you guys were involved. But you start reading about it and you say, wow, why don't we do something about this? Isn't this an effective way to stop settlement funding? My past litigation experience, by the way, I was a I clerked at Cravath, Swain & Moore, and I was a litigation associate at Proskauer Rose. I learned there that you must have a focus on your litigation. So this is one step, I hope a positive step, to stop the funding of settlement expansion. Because you can talk all you want, but Netanyahu and his crew are just building settlements up the wazoo. In fact, just a week ago, a guy near Ariel said, you know, I saw the bulldozers come. I know they're going to evict me. I have no money. I have no weapons. I can't defend myself. I'm going to lose all my property. And he lives right near Ariel. So my point is settlement expansion is still going on, and Israeli government officials have been lying to Congress for probably 30 years. And through devious means, confiscation of state property, confiscation of property for bogus security reasons, they basically have demolished, I think, 49,000 Palestinian homes, and they've built 56,000 new apartment buildings and homes in the OPT, clear evidence of ethnic cleansing. And then Seamus and I started to realize, wow, settlement expansion is a very profitable game. No wonder they're not going to stop. In fact, if you just take the 26,000 homes that were sold and you use REMAX property values, REMAX, Bank Leumi, and, well, I guess, who else, Seamus? The housing developers. You know what they grossed? $9.5 billion.
Wow.
Holy moly.
And
yeah,
then if you consider the infrastructure improvements and apartment buildings and shopping malls and everything under the sun, It's about $30 billion. So the bottom line is, you know, follow the money, folks. The KISS theory. This is a very attractive investment for all concerned, and we're not going to stop even if we're violating Israeli criminal law and we're promoting ethnic cleansing.
How come you sued the Department of Treasury? Why didn't you sue the donors or the not-for-profits that funneled this money over there? How come you went after the Department of Treasury?
Well, I think this is a two-step dance for us. The first step is to sue the administrative agency that has the authority and the staff to investigate money laundering, to investigate tax-exempt entities, and to revoke their status. So this is the first step, I think, in our campaign to help the Palestinian people. And unless you start with the administrative agency who is in charge, you're not going to go anywhere. And plus, a litigator's dream is to have other people do the hard, heavy lifting. So I hope Treasury does a lot of hard work and gives us evidence of what we think is really, you know, a pattern of criminal activity on the part of these 501c3s and the donors themselves. And that can provide us with an opportunity to address your issue, sir, about going after the donors.
Well, what do you estimate the amount of tax revenue that the U.S. government has lost as a consequence of these not-for-profits?
Well, it's probably somewhere between $500 billion and $1 trillion. Of course, we don't know, but I'll tell you why we came up with that range of values, if you will. And, you know, keep in mind, I don't care if it's $5. When you're promoting ethnic cleansing and you're stealing somebody's private property, excuse me, that's wrong. 501c3 shouldn't be doing that. Anyway, you start with the tax-exempt entities. They should have been declaring for the last 30 years as income the donations sent by Stanley Adelson. They didn't. That's an enormous sum. There's at least 140, maybe 150, for all we know, 250 pro-settlement tax-exempt entities. So the first pocket is, what are all the monies you received which you didn't declare as income? We want that. And then there are back taxes, penalties, income. It's interest, because it's incredible. You guys should know, if you talk to an IRS auditor or you talk to a tax accountant, it's not the tax itself. It's the incredible penalties and accrued interest. You know, a $100 obligation is $1,000 in 3 weeks. Anyway, that's one source. The second source is the donors. Look, let's take Yale University. You should not have been taking illegal deductions for 30 years to fund Yale University. It's an illegal. It's on somebody's private property, and our public policies, you shouldn't do that. So if Adelson has been taking $500 million over 30 years in tax write-offs for Yale University, they can be disallowed, and that money should be recouped, and then you add on the penalties and everything. And then keep in mind, the relief we're asking for is not just to go after pro-settlement entities, but any 501c3 that's sending money overseas to promote either violence, in violation of Bill Clinton's 95 executive order, or to promote activities like ethnic cleansing, theft of private property. You know, you're violating Treasury regs, and as we lay out in the lawsuit, they violate at least 8 federal criminal statutes. So I hope that answers your question.
It does.
Martin, do you believe these not-for-profit entities should be classified as so-called special designated global terrorists?
Good question. If you look at what the standard was for OFAC to designate...
That's the Office of Foreign Asset Control,
Division
of the Treasury.
Right. Do you know that AIPAC set that up 10 years ago to make sure that we could go after Iran? That was the whole... That was the AIPAC policy. And they put their man in place, too, at Libby. Anyway, if you look at the standard OFAC used to go after a Hezbollah official about a month ago. And then the standard they used to go after, I think it was Venezuelan officials about 6 months ago, they have more than adequate evidence to designate folks like Adelson, friends of the Israeli Defense Forces who have been sending $100 million to fund the Israeli army. Clearly they have that kind of evidence. And maybe you guys don't know this, I've done extensive research on it. Do you know that OFAC can designate people on the basis of newspaper articles.
No.
And if you read the L.A. Times article we started in a lawsuit, they could nail Moskowitz. I mean, that article lays out how he manipulates or uses tax-exempt entities as either funnels or what are called financial pass-throughs. In other words, the bottom line here is I'm Mr. Adelson, okay? And I could sympathize with him. You want to fund Ariel. Okay, so write him a check for $10 million. Hello and goodbye. Well, Adelson says, you know, if I do that, Martin, I don't get a tax write-off. So let me set up my own little tax foundation, or let me talk to the folks at the Friends of Ariel. And you see, I'll deposit the money there, Martin, for 24 hours, and then it goes to Ariel, and I get to write off $10 million. My point is, I don't like that, Stanley. Your political agenda is being subsidized by the American taxpayer. I'd love to send $10 million to my mother's village in Ireland. I don't have the money, but I wouldn't want my fellow Americans to say, isn't that a marvelous decision on the part of Martin? Let's support that. So what they're doing is actively subsidizing Adelson, Moskowitz, Hagee's political agenda. They're even doing it in East Jerusalem, too. They're setting up their own little Jewish enclave.
Martin, is there any prior history of similar litigation? And if so, with what results?
Well, good question again. I don't think Treasury has been sued in this capacity, although we're looking into it. But a lot of agencies are sued under that statute. The problem is that most of the folks who have gone after some part of this puzzle have been confronted with the political question doctrine. Stanley Cohen is a New York City lawyer.
We know Stanley. Yeah.
Well, I know him. And anyway, he basically filed a lawsuit and then stamped his head with, please dismiss my lawsuit, judge, because it invokes a political question. So you have to stay clear of the political question doctrine. So why am I so confident about this suit and maybe a potential suit against the donors? Hey, Your Honor, we're talking about an American administrative agency called Treasury. We're talking about American donors. We're talking about American 501c3s. We're talking about American taxpayers who are getting screwed. So there's no political question here, and we want to keep it simple. Treasury, do your job. So all the cases we found always get down to political question, and you ask the judge, Your Honor, can you declare that Israel is a terrorist state? You know, you're not going to go anywhere. Are you guys familiar with the Rachel Corrie suit?
Yes.
Yes.
You see, Rachel Corrie lost out in the American courts because the Pentagon basically has a deal with Caterpillar to provide all that stuff. So the judge latched onto that and threw them out on the basis of the political question. Who am I to question congressional intent here? The Defense Department is supposed to do this. Let them do it. And then they got screwed by the Israeli government or the Israeli courts because they concluded she was in a war zone. Of course, even if you're in a war zone and you're not carrying any weapons and you're wearing an orange reflective outfit, it's pretty difficult to rationalize murdering her. In fact, that tractor ran over her twice. So any of the lawsuits that we've seen always give the judge an opening to say, well, you know, I'd love to help you out, Martin. You know, I meet you every year at the annual litigation conference. You're a good guy, but, you know, I'm going to throw your case out. So if you have a political question, like Stanley said, and stamped it on his forehead, please dismiss my lawsuit, Your Honor.
Well, Martin, what relief is your lawsuit seeking?
Adopting the KISS standard. Please, Treasury, do your job. I don't know how much money you can recoup, but you know what? American foreign policy is clear. It goes back to 92. Jim Baker said, we're not going to let the American tax code subsidize settlement growth and all that goes with it. He told the then Israeli ambassador. So not only would they be enforcing American public policy, they would be able to recoup for taxpayers somewhere between $500 billion and $1 trillion. If you guys are old enough, I don't know if you remember Irv Dirksen, was it? He said, after a while, it becomes real money.
I do remember him. Martin, this all goes back to those territories that were snatched in the 67 war. I believe they're illegal under the Geneva Accords. Is that correct?
Well, you know, we say in our lawsuit, legal schmeagle. You know, you're promoting ethnic cleansing. You're promoting violence. You're violating Bill Clinton's 95 executive order. You know, a 501c3 shouldn't be doing that. However, it is very clear to us, based upon the 1995 Sasson report, that they are indeed illegal. Settlements have to jump through a number of hoops. architectural drawings, delineations, proper ownership, registration of title, all sorts of things, which these guys never did. And I'm not saying that. Comptroller Goldstein is saying it in 2003. Sassoon is saying it in 2005. And the Israeli government published in Haaretz, fortunately, their own findings in 2009, that indeed these companies have been stealing private property and using bogus construction permits to build up the settlements. So even if you forget about the Geneva Convention, which I think applies, and the HCJ, the Supreme Court has said it does apply, even though settlement advocates like Abrams says otherwise, it's clear that Geneva Conventions apply if you read the decisions of the Israeli Supreme Court. But even if you don't, you know, how do you prove that you're legal? They can't. And they violated, in terms of stealing state property, or one of the ruses is they convinced the area military commander to say, you see those 500 acres out there, olive groves? I want them designated as state property. Okay, we'll do. So the area military commander issues an order, this is state property. However, if you look at the Ottoman land code and the Jordanian land code, when you do a designation involving state property, that can't be used for a residential settlement expansion, housing development. It has to be a public park. It's a public purpose. And if you look at the Ottoman land code, you realize, boy, this state declaration stuff is an unusual venture. So the problem that the settlement leaders face is that every day, aggressive settlers are coming out looking for cheap real estate. Now, there ain't any around. And around the settlement is Palestinian property. What do? We have to get rid of these dudes, you know? Screw them. So they'll use violence and eventually convince the Palestinian homeowners to leave because there's no other state property available. In fact, in 1992, Premier, what was his name, Seamus? The Prime Minister told Jim Baker, verbal assurances, we will no longer use state property to promote settlement expansion. So any settlement expansion that occurred after 92 is per se illegal. So you don't have to hang your hat on the Geneva Convention, although it's a good peg under international law.
Well, we've been speaking with Washington, D.C. Attorney Martin McMahon. Martin, we're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you one last question, if I might. What are your hopes and expectations for your lawsuit?
Well, it's funny you ask that. We structured the lawsuit so that Americans would be encouraged to join. For example, it only costs $150 to join. That's your maximum. That's it. So I'd like more American taxpayers to join in to convince the judge that they recognize what the problem is. My hope is that Treasury does a comprehensive investigation. And you know what? If some of these tax-exempt entities are legal, they don't do anything wrong, fine. Don't revoke their status. But I'll tell you what, I think a majority of these 501c3s can be revoked in terms of their status on a number of bases. They violated 5 or 6 Treasury regs. They violated 8 federal criminal statutes. So I think it's pretty clear that if Treasury, which has the resources to do this, goes and does its job, we're going to stop settlement funding. And if you stop settlement funding, you're going to stop settlement expansion. And that's the only way to convince Netanyahu to come to the table and work things out. So right. There's a bit of me as an optimist in terms of hopefully the lawsuit will generate some sort of peaceful dialogue, and there will be leadership profiles of courage on both sides, which isn't there today, unfortunately.
Well, Martin, before we say goodbye, Heidi and I would like to join the lawsuit.
Yes.
Tell us how, and our listeners will learn how to do it also. So please tell us, what do we do to join the lawsuit?
If you send in a check today for $150, we'll send you a free vacuum cleaner. No, all you have to do is send us a check for $150, and then tell us in an email, Mr. McMahon or Martin, I want to join the lawsuit because I think Treasury is not doing its job, and I'm opposed to settlement expansion. I think if you read Michael Saville's affidavit, that impedes foreign policy objectives. All we want is to make sure we don't have a lot of yahoos saying, yeah, I'd like to get in the lawsuit to screw those Jews, you know? So as long as you have a valid reason for joining our lawsuit, great. $150, I kid you about the vacuum cleaner, but that was a joke that George Carlin used lots of times.
And what is your email address, Martin?
MM@MartinMahon.com. Seamus, give them your email address, too.
Yeah, it's almost the same. It's WF as in Fox at martinmcmahonlaw.com. MartinMcMahonLaw.com.
Great. And since we're getting a lot of requests for personal interviews with our plaintiffs, maybe you could, in the email, say, I won't mind if you give out my details for a reporter to talk to me, because reporters don't want to talk to attorneys, as I figured out a long time ago. They want to talk to the plaintiffs to find out, you know, get red meat.
Martin and Seamus, too, thank you so much for your wonderful interview and for a lawsuit that we fully support.
Well, it's nice to hear that, Heidi. I'll tell you something. I know I'm going to lose all my Jewish clients. And I used to coach Little League Baseball for 7 years, and I'm sure stories will start to surface that I abuse those kids.
Well,
the Israeli lobby is
powerful.
You know, yeah. Oh, yeah, unfortunately.
We know.
There's a substantial number of Jews, especially younger Jews, who are totally on our side on this one. I count myself one of them.
That?
You're going to get support for this, Martin.
Why do you conclude that?
Because I follow Jewish Voice for Peace. They've gotten a huge number of people to join them in the last year. They're very active on hundreds of campuses across the country. I will put you in touch with them. They may like you to go out and speak. You know, there's a fundamental prophetic voice in Judaism that's been wiped out by these Zionists, and it's coming back and to their honor. So you're going to get a lot of support for this, Martin. Mark my words.
Yeah.
But I only have 4 vacuum cleaners left.
So sell them a piece of the old sod.
All right. Well, George is smiling on me, I think. So.
You take it easy and best of luck.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
No find them as in them at the best. But when it comes to the test, I know them are one best. Oh, so take a seat and then you take a rest. I leave it to the people to suggest who are the best, who are the best in a teacher contest. Boy, boy.
After 9/11, and now in response to recent events around the globe, thousands of innocent Muslims continue to be monitored, entrapped, and arrested in the name of subverting radicalized terrorism. Hateful rhetoric from presidential candidate Donald Trump and others have inflamed anti-Muslim stereotypes and led to numerous instances of hate crimes. Joining us to discuss law enforcement ideologies and strategies, as well as the general public's perceptions of Muslims, is Arun Khandani, author of the 2014 book, The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. Born and bred in London, Arun moved to New York in 2010 on a fellowship with the Open Society Foundation. He lives in Harlem. He's also the author of The End of Tolerance, Racism in 21st Century Britain, selected as a New Statesman Book of the Year in 2007. A former editor of the journal Race and Class, he attended Cambridge University, holds a PhD from London Metropolitan University, and teaches at New York University.
Arun, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
We had you on a year ago. Would you say that there has been, since that interview, a rise in Islamophobia in this country?
It does seem that way. I mean, it's an issue that has obviously come to the fore in the last couple of months with the stuff from Donald Trump about his Muslim ban and the kind of aftermath of San Bernardino. But actually, it's not really about those events. It's been bubbling up, continuously over the last year or two. And, you know, we had the murder in North Carolina of three Muslim students in a hate crime in March, I think, this year, you know, way before Paris, way before the San Bernardino attacks. So I think it is something that's generally been bubbling up over the last 4 or 5 years, actually, in particular.
Arun, Islamophobia means fear of Islam. I suspect that most Americans don't know very much about Islam. My understanding that Islam, which came after Judaism and then Christianity and then Islam, I suspect that Islam is really built on the basics of the first two religions. Could you tell us in a nutshell what people who believe in Islam believe?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I actually think that, I mean, I can go into the detail of, you know, the kind of five pillars of Islam and those kind of basic beliefs. And you're right that the religion is one of the three monotheistic religions and kind of incorporates Judaism and Christianity. Jesus is considered one of the prophets in Islam and so forth. But really, this issue of Islamophobia is not really about the content of the religion, you know. And so conservatives want to argue that there's something inherent in Islam that produces terrorism. After 9/11, you saw loads of people in the United States go out and buy copies of the Quran because they thought maybe somewhere on page 120 or something they'd find this line that says, go out and kill Americans. Of course, that's not how religions work. And so in response to this kind of conservative argument that Islam is a religion of violence, you get this kind of liberal argument that says, No, Islam is a religion of peace. And on one level, that's kind of true. You can kind of make an argument that there is a kind of mainstream version of Islam that values peace. But really, that debate ends up in a dead end for me, because then you just have this process where each side trades quotations from the Quran. You know, conservatives can find quotations from the Quran that sound pretty violent. Liberals can find quotations from the Quran that sound quite peaceful. And what all of that misses is that Islam, like any religion, is open to multiple interpretations. There is no essential meaning to what the religion represents. And so the question then is under what circumstances, under what social and political and historical circumstances, do people interpret the religion according to its more militant verses and texts, or according to its more peaceful texts, right? And the big question for people who want to argue that Islam is a religion that has some kind of inherent connection to terrorism, the big problem for them is, how do you explain that, you know, until the last century or so, no one interpreted Islam that way, right? I mean, you know, if you went to ask scholars, you know, 150 years ago, what is the politics of Islam? They would say, well, it's a quietist religion. It seems to be the most passive religion politically. It seems to be opposed to rebellion and revolution. And now we believe the opposite. Now we believe it's the most radical religion, right? And the point is not that somehow people have made, there's not been a theological transformation in how people understand the religion. There's been a political transformation in the situation of Muslims in the world. And people are trying to find ways of using the religion to address that political context. And that's really where the heart of this issue is. And so Islamophobia is not, for me, it's not actually about a fear of Islam. It's actually about racism against Muslims. And it's political more than religious.
How would you analyze the events in Paris and in San Bernardino? How should we understand those events?
You know, again, this is where I think we have seen an overemphasis on kind of religious ideology and an underemphasis on the political circumstances that give rise to these kinds of events. So, and actually the two events are rather different. Let's start with Paris. You know, I think when you look at what does the war on terror represent, right? The war on terror represented a basic promise that we would inflict violence over there, as it were, to prevent violence from happening over here. And so what that misunderstands is that violence will always return home, right? You can't have a situation in a globalized world where you you know, you bomb civilians in the Middle East and think that that violence will somehow be contained to the Middle East, right? Eventually, people will bring that violence back to Europe and the United States. I think that's the lesson of events like Paris. That's the lesson of the, you know, 7/7 terrorist attacks that took place in London in 2005. So I think you know, broadly speaking, with the way in which we need to understand these incidents are on those terms. San Bernardino is somewhat different because, to me, that incident is represents Muslims integrating themselves into American gun culture, actually, right? And this is one of the ironies here is that, you know, we decided that was a terrorist attack very quickly, and we categorized it very differently from all the other kinds of mass shootings that take place in the United States almost every day. But, you know, apart from the fact that the perpetrators issued a kind of declaration of some kind of allegiance to ISIS in the midst of the attack, there's no reason to look at it as any different from the mass shootings that take place all the time. And to me, it represents actually a slightly broader trend of a number of incidents now where people have carried out mass shootings and then flagged it as somehow related to ISIS. But really what's going on there is a mass shooting incident.
Speaking of high-profile events such as those, can you talk about how the media may fuel Islamophobia in the way that it reports on these events?
Right, and I think that connects to what we were just talking about. So, you know, the use of the word terrorism, the use of the word extremism, the use of the word radicalization, I think, are kind of key to this, right? So we only use those words when Muslims carry out acts of violence in the United States. We don't use them when a right-wing racist carries out an attack on a black church. We don't use them when a neo-Nazi shoots a Sikh temple, right? So the way that the vocabulary is deployed very selectively, I think, creates this idea in people's minds that the greatest fear facing the United States is the fear of Muslim terrorists, right? When the numbers just don't back that up. I mean, the number of New America Foundation compiles data on what it calls terrorism, according to a slightly different definition of terrorism to the kind of mainstream media, one that's still problematic. But, you know, according to their data, a lot more people have been killed in terrorist attacks by right-wing extremists than by Muslim terrorists since 9/11, right? But we don't label those normally as terrorism, so we don't fear them as much. You know, the oldest terrorist organization in the United States is the Ku Klux Klan, right? We never consider them normally to be a terrorist organization, but that's essentially what they are. The reality is you're far more likely to be killed by your own spouse than by Muslim terrorists in the United States, right? And we have lost more than 400,000 people to gun-related crime in the United States since 9/11, right? I mean, that's the size of a small country. And compared to that, something like 45 people killed by Muslim terrorists since 9/11 in the United States. So our perception of where the threats of violence to us come from is skewed, completely skewed out of all proportion.
Yeah, that's a powerful statistic. I think you have more of a chance of getting killed by a bee sting than by a Muslim terrorist.
Yeah, you're more likely to die from an accident in your bathtub than from terrorism in the United States.
But let's talk about ISIS. How do you analyze ISIS?
Right. So I think, you know, one of the things that has happened, especially on the left, is that we have tended not to say very much about what ISIS represents and what it's, you know, what drives it, what its ideology is, because, you know, faced with this very powerful conservative argument that says, you know, ISIS represents radical Islam, and is somehow connected to Islam as a religion, we have tended to instead just want to say, well, no, this is, you know, ISIS is nothing to do with Islam. It's just the kind of byproduct of US wars in the Middle East, and not say anything more about it. I don't think that quite works, particularly now that ISIS, you know, actually, it differs from Al-Qaeda in the sense that it actually controls territory, right? And is able to impose its own kind of political administration over that territory to some extent. And again, we need to distinguish between, you know, the kind of the nature of ISIS as a quasi kind of state in the Middle East, and you know, what might lead a young kid growing up in Europe to want to travel to Iraq and Syria to join ISIS, and two are slightly different. As far as ISIS as an entity in Syria and Iraq is concerned, of course, you know, we can't state this often enough, that of course it's the product of complete chaos and carnage that was the result of the 2003 war in Iraq and the aftermath of that, the sectarianism that was fueled after that. It's the product of the Saudi and Gulf elites who funded this sectarian ideology. It's the product of also, you know, Russia and Iran's support of Bashar al-Assad, which has created the climate in which ISIS can thrive. And Bashar al-Assad's government obviously kills way more civilians than ISIS does. But beyond that, it's also, you know, and this is where I think the story is interesting. When you look at why would someone who's grown up in, say, London or Paris, working class person of color, 19 years old, why would that person travel to Iraq and Syria and join Islamic State? And you know, here, I mean, this is not about ideology corrupting that young kid, as the standard kind of models of radicalization would argue. They would say, you know, somehow this kind of jihadist ideology brainwashes kids into leaving. I don't think that's really what's going on. In fact, I don't think it's about ideology radicalizing. I think it's the absence of ideology, and it's actually the absence of any real radicalization taking place in the genuine sense of the word. What these kids are starving for is visions of a better world, right? That can offer an alternative to the racism, the imperialism, and the poverty that they're growing up with and they're seeing every day on the news. And what ISIS offers is an alternative. It says, here is a utopian vision of a different kind of society. It's one that is incredibly simplistic and flawed in every possible way politically. It has a simple message, which is, you know, there is a war going on between the West and Islam, and you have to choose sides. Are you combatant for the West, or are you combatant for Islam? And a very small number of Muslims in Europe are saying, I want to be a combatant for Islam. In fact, a very small number of non-Muslims are saying, I want to also be a combatant for Islam, because this society that I've grown up in is bankrupt. You know, what that means for us on the left is we're not doing a good enough job of offering visions of social progress that can be a more compelling alternative. And, you know, particularly at a time when in Europe, the left has tended to suburbanize, it's tended to gentrify and leave behind a lot of those communities of color, you know, where these recruits are being drawn from.
Yeah, I think what you've just said is very profound.
Just to follow up on the events in this country, do you think that presidential candidate Donald Trump is doing damage in terms of inflaming anti-Muslim sentiment?
I think he is. I mean, I think, you know, what we need to understand about Trump is that he is making explicit in his rhetoric what is already implicit in our actual policy in the United States, right? So the we already have a situation where we deported thousands upon thousands of Muslims after 9/11, right? The Muslim ban that he's called for, we implemented that already. We already have a situation where, you know, every mosque in New York City has been under surveillance by the New York Police Department since 9/11. We already, the majority of governors in the United States already banned Syrian refugees from coming here to claim asylum. The policies that he's calling for are largely already in place. We already have, you know, over a million people on the terrorism watch list, right? But his rhetoric, of course, does make a difference. I mean, it makes a difference to the hate crimes, exactly, which we've seen increase. Apparently, we've seen increase a little over that last few weeks when this has been part of the news. I mean, I think it creates an atmosphere, right? It changes the mood. It means that Muslim cab driver is a little bit more anxious about whether the passenger is going to turn aggressive. You know, we know that, you know, these kinds of attacks happen all the time. The veiled Muslim woman on the subway is a little bit more anxious about the way people are looking at her.
Does the Southern Poverty Law Center track this kind of hate crime?
We don't have accurate data on hate crimes in general, right? I mean, there is a system of reporting
to the FBI that local police departments are meant to engage in, but it's, I mean, everyone agrees that it's hugely underreported. I mean, there's underreporting in terms of people being anxious about going to the police, let alone whether the police then report that to the FBI and it gets collated. I mean, for my book, I try to gather some sense of the data here and you know, collected a lot of local news reports about attacks, and it was clear, and that was in 2010 or so, it was clear that there was, you know, there was stuff like this happening all the time, every week across the United States, where very serious incidents of anti-Muslim violence taking place. And, you know, and what's interesting is that violence increased, clearly increased fairly dramatically around 2009, 2010.
And why was that? That?
Why was that? Well, so what that tells us is that it's certainly not, this violence is not about a kind of spontaneous reaction to 9/11, right? There's a little bit of a reaction after 9/11, but really the real uptick in racist violence against Muslims happens around 2009, 2010. The reason is because you start to get a more intensified kind of Islamophobic propaganda campaign around then, which is motivated by trying to discredit Obama, right? Which, because remember, you know, the kind of one strand of conservative attacks on Obama has been he's secretly a Muslim, right? And this kind of conspiracy theory that you know, that the Muslim Brotherhood are secretly controlling the American government and all that kind of stuff that you'll find on the kind of online chat about, you know, about Obama amongst these kind of conservative Islamophobic networks. So that, it's not a fringe thing, right? That conspiracy theory. I mean, something like, I think the current opinion poll data says that something like 46% of Republicans believe that Obama is secretly a Muslim. And this is the 21st century equivalent of the old anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, you know, that Jews are secretly controlling the world. Well, now the theory is, you know, Muslims are secretly controlling the world. Look at the most powerful person in the world. Obama is secretly a Muslim, right? So so I think that's why you see, and the fact that this is a way to discredit Obama speaks to the fact that this is as much about race as it is about religion. And of course, Obama has not, and his team have not been particularly principled in their response to this. I mean, they've systematically tried to ensure that Obama is never seen near Muslims, right? I mean, he doesn't visit mosques. In his campaign, in his last presidential campaign, his team had women wearing veils removed from the background. When he visited India. I forget when, but around about 2010, and he was invited to visit the Golden Temple in Amritsar, which is a Sikh temple, not a Muslim temple. But you know, in the kind of stereotypical image of a terrorist, you see a man with a turban, and Sikhs wear turbans. So he would have been photographed with a lot of people wearing turbans, and anyone going into that temple is supposed to wear a turban themselves. So his team asked if he could just wear an American baseball cap instead. So it sounds, you know, so he looks properly American and there's no suspicion that he might be a terrorist wearing a turban. Well, of course, you can't wear an American baseball cap in the most, you know, sacred right. Sikh temple in the world. So the visit was pulled off.
No.
Because of the photograph would have played to the kind of Islamophobic conservative narrative. But he should have just said, I happen not to be a Muslim, right. But if right. I was, it wouldn't make any difference.
Right.
One of the other great deceptions, I think, is the lack of any analysis or publicity about the role of Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
And that's going all the way back to 9/11. And the senator who was in charge of the Senate Select Committee on 9/11 was a distinguished Florida senator named Bob Graham. And he's been campaigning to release the 20 pages of that report the Senate issued, which were censored. And, of course, if he released it, he'd be imprisoned. So what mm-hmm. he did was he wrote a novel, which essentially says what those 20 mm-hmm. pages say. And I read the novel. And here's what the novel says. Graham writes this novel in a key, and he says that there were elements of the Saudi royal family, which is intertwined with the Saudi government, they're really one and the same, that financed 9/11. Mm. And then they go further and says that Osama bin Laden, who comes from that royal family, was quite disturbed about several aspects of American policy and Israeli policy. Mm. One was the Americans using sanctions against Iraq, which killed something like 600,000 Iraqi children. Madeleine Albright, the Secretary of State at the time, admitted to it and said on national TV that she thought that was worth it. Mm-hmm. And the other was the American bases in Saudi Arabia near the two great shrines of Islam, Mecca and Medina. Bin Laden wanted those out. And then American support for Israel and its oppression of the Palestinians. Those, according to Graham, were the three motivations. And none of that's discussed. And I wonder what your reaction is to that.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to me that we focus so little on this issue. I mean, we have chosen the most reactionary regime in the Middle East after Israel to be our second ally after Israel, right? I mean, the Saudi, you mentioned the Saudi royal family. Saudi Arabia is the only country in the world where the name of the ruling family is part of the name of the country, right? I mean, the House of Saud is part of the name of the country. It's as if this country was called, Bush Clintonistan or something, right? I mean, it's like that. So the fact that they are our, closest ally after Israel should be a national scandal. And because of that relationship, the US government does turn a blind eye and did turn a blind eye. I mean, I don't think we know exactly what was going on in the run up to 9/11. And I don't personally believe any of the conspiracy theories about an inside job, but I think it's reasonable to say that part of the problem that meant that 9/11 was not detected was due to a long-standing close relationship between the United States government and the Saudi regime, right? And Bin Laden was someone that we saw as someone who at one time had been on our side, and I don't think people took him seriously as a threat to the United States as much as they should have done because of that. So. We haven't learned those lessons, and we still have this relationship. Elements of the Saudi elite and the other Gulf state elites do seem to have funded ISIS, at least in its early stages, right, as part of a sectarian war against. I mean, ultimately, they see their main enemy as Iran, and saw. Funding these Salafi groups in Syria as a way of countering Assad and Iran, right? I think if we were serious, and of course we're not serious, but if we were serious about trying to improve the situation of people in the Middle East, of ending authoritarian regimes, of ending war, we would begin with our relationship with Saudi Arabia and just abandon that relationship. And historically, the kind of pragmatic argument for that relationship was that we depend on them for our oil. But, I mean, we get most of our oil from Canada now, right? I mean, we should be spending as much time talking about Canada as we do about the Middle East if it's about energy resources, right?
Well, we're running out of time.
I wish we didn't have to end here, but we're exceeding our time. But as usual, it's wonderful, Arun, to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
My and we look forward to another update soon.
Great. Thank
Thanks
you.
Thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.